This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
And g'day, Jessica Hayes with you today, sitting in for Belinda Varaschetti on this beautiful Friday. And it's so great to have you along on the Country Hour this afternoon, right across regional WA. And on the program, an extremely rare double diamond has been discovered at Ellendale in the West Kimberley. How does this sound to you? An ancient 0.8 carat gem, which contains a second diamond inside.
So I was in the diamond room with the process plant manager when it jumped up and we looked at it and thought, what's this? This is a really strange diamond. It looks like exactly that. We thought that it was a stone or something inside of the diamond, but it was clear.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Diamond trapped inside a diamond. It was, a bit exciting.
Pretty amazing, huh? If diamonds are a girl's best friend, that one sounds absolutely ideal. You'll hear more from India Board Diamond Holdings Managing Director Peter McNally shortly. And a bit later, mining billionaire Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation has released a report card about global fish stocks and the activity of fishing nations around the world. Top marks went to Ireland, Latvia and Norway. They got Cs. And you'll find out how Australia's performance stacks up and our grades after the news headlines and the weather at 12:30. And before the news at 1, a wrap of this week's Wool Market with Danny Burkett. And remember that if you'd like to be part of the conversation this afternoon, if you're out in the orchard, on the header or out on the boat, you can flick me a text. The number is 0448 922 604. That number again, 0448 922 604. And just remember to include your name and where you're from. I'd love to hear from you this afternoon on the Country Hour. Kicking off the show, though, agriculture, forestry and fishing have once again been labelled the most dangerous industries in Australia. That's the summary from Safe Work Australia, because serious injury claims in those industries are on the rise. Richard Franklin is a professor in public health and he's also the director of the World Safety Organisation Collaborating Centre. And he says given the current labour shortage problems affecting agriculture, a lot more needs to be done right now to keep people safe.
Look, I'm not surprised. I'm somewhat disappointed in the numbers. I mean, the numbers have been the same over the last probably 5 or 6 years with very little change in what we're seeing. And we know that agriculture is a dynamic and changing workplace. And so there are inherent risks in what you're doing. But you still, when we look at it, it is one of the most dangerous industries to work in. And so there's a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that we keep people safe so that they come home at night to their loved ones.
These numbers refer specifically to workplace injury claims. To what extent does that capture an accurate picture of just how dangerous the workplace is in agriculture in Australia?
Yeah, it's not a very good representation. It covers about 60% of the people in agriculture. It's one of the lowest industries that are covered under the workers' compensation sort of scheme. We've got a lot of small and medium-sized enterprises with a lot of self-employed people, so they don't come under that scheme. So when you look at it, it's actually an underrepresentation from a numbers perspective. And that's one of the things that's a bit worrying when you look at it, that the numbers are still pretty high considering that we aren't including everybody. There is a bit of a skew when you look at it towards a younger cohort. We tend to find that as people get a bit older in agriculture, they do go out on their own and start up their own businesses. They're not super accurate, but what it does say is that, you know, we do have some challenges for us in agriculture around what we need to do to try and keep people safe and make sure that people don't get injured while they're working.
The numbers of instances of workplace injury have actually risen slightly since 2017 in Australian ag. Are the strategies that we're pursuing in order to mitigate those injuries just not working? Why is it that we've stalled in this way?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, if you look back about 20 years ago to the late 90s, early 2000s, we've kind of reduced it by about a third from what we're seeing there. But certainly the last, 6 or 7 years, it's really plateaued and we haven't seen much change in it. That probably says to me that some of the low-hanging fruit, we've got in and managed to address some of those issues, but there's a lot of things that we still need to do and keep people safe as part of the process. And I'm kind of hoping that we're starting to think about, we talk about the hierarchy of control, so eliminating some of the risks, but really thinking about our total risk-based approach to your workplace and not just workplace health and safety being an add-on. And again, when we talk about the workers' comp stuff, it is really a particular group of people that go in. So one, you've got to be covered under the scheme. But secondly, you've got to reach a certain threshold, i.e. that there's got to be a cost of, you've got to spend more than 10 days off work to actually then be included in that. So, you know, it really is concerning. And it's concerning that unlike other areas where we're seeing a bit of a downward trend, we're stagnated in the agricultural sector.
What do you suppose the implications are of the additional stress that many farmers may be under this year in particular?
My guess is that we're going to see more people being injured. People will be working longer hours because they just don't have the labour to get onto the property and help out. There'll be a lot of people that previously would have just been providing sort of a management role that'll be doing two roles, so i.e. doing their management and also bringing in the crop. So my suspicion is that we're going to see more people injured. So it is a real concern, and, you know, a big call out to keep an eye out for fatigue and make sure that you're putting some really good strategies in place to don't end up being killed or having a significant injury, which can then totally derail you getting the crop off.
When the strategy is undertaken of, you know, regulating our way to improved safety, there is a certain amount of resistance. The example that comes to mind for me is the regulations associated with quad bikes only a few weeks ago. That wasn't necessarily received well by a lot of farmers, and the same might be said for a lot of other regulations associated with improved safety. Where do you think the benefits are to be found, given that people don't necessarily want to change their practices or their tools, and those tools and practices might be dangerous to a certain extent?
Yeah, look, I think this is the million-dollar question for us. And what you're talking about there is how do we improve the culture around safety so that, you know, people are thinking about it and it's at the forefront of their mind. And I'm with you. I mean, I think that regulation can only go so far. And I think one of the things that we've got to make sure that we do when we regulate is that people understand why that regulation's in place, what the need for it is, and that they've got the tools to be able to deal with and address that. And often, you know, we see people trying to cut corners, and I get it. You know, you want to do things faster, you want to get the crop off, and that may then lead to consequences as part of that process. So again, for me, regulation's only one part of the story. I don't think you can ever regulate your way out of any situation if people aren't aware of it. People don't know what to do. And if people are only turning up after the event, that's not a preventative kind of solution. But we do need to be able to change behaviour, and that's one of the tools that are there. It's challenging. And as I said, I think some of the easy stuff has been done. We now need to think about culture, and we now need to think about the way that we work and the systems that we put in place to try and keep people safe.
James Cook, University Professor Richard Franklin, who is an expert in farm safety. And he was talking to Angus McIntosh about the latest workers' compensation figures from Safe Work Australia. And you can read more on that story on the ABC Rural website. Just search ABC Rural Farm and Safety. It's 12 minutes past 12. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, an extremely rare double diamond unearthed in the Kimberley has stirred a lot of excitement in the industry. The discovery comes as the race to restart the mothballed Ellendale diamond mine heats up, which is famous for its exquisite fancy yellows. Courtney Fowler has the story.
Have you ever heard of a Matryoshka diamond? Named after the traditional Russian nesting dolls, the term is used to describe a diamond which is formed within another larger diamond. Finding a double diamond is extremely rare, even for mining veteran Peter McNally. It's a once-in-a-lifetime find.
It was. I was in the diamond room with the process plant manager when it jumped up, and we looked at it and thought, what's this? This is a really strange diamond. We thought that it was a stone or something inside of the diamond, but it was clear, so we thought, well, a diamond trapped inside a diamond. It was, a bit exciting.
There's only a handful of double diamonds like this around the world. The unique gem was discovered in the Kimberley's Ellendale province, famous for its fancy yellow diamonds.
They say that, you know, it was one crystal at a time and then a bit broke away and formed inside the other one. And the other theory is that they're two separate stones, and one trapped the other. And, you know, it was done high temperature, high pressure, I think 1,400 million years ago. But it also has a rare purple glow. It fluoresces this rare purple glow under ultraviolet light. So it is a special diamond and quite rare.
Peter McNally again there. His company is working with Perth-based Delta Diamond Laboratory to study the relationship between fluorescence and the origins of the signature Ellendale yellow.
And that's all about creating that fingerprint or signature, which is important now for provenance. buyers want to know where they come from. They want to know about the behaviour of the miner, his environmental and social and community credentials, and how you get on with the other neighbours and the traditional owners and the like. So they're all important now to people who are purchasing high-quality diamonds.
And that kind of work is important to you for when you look to market these diamonds and particularly, I suppose, the fancy yellows. Just how close are you getting to being able to get back into production there at Ellendale?
Oh, we're very close to that now. We believe that we will have our government approval to commence small-scale commercial mining in January. The exploration that was done this last year was excellent. We have the Aboriginal people have cleared our mining lease. We're dotting the I's and crossing the T's with the MIRs now on the mining proposal and expect to be going quite soon.
India Bore Diamond Holdings are one of several miners working towards restarting production at the Mothbald Mine southeast of Derby. The race to kickstart Kimberley's diamond industry heated up last year following the closure of Australia's only operational diamond mine at Argyle. Luke Harper Diamond Company is another big player in the region. They've just identified three new targets at the Brooking Project east of Ellendale.
We've been delivering results there since 2018, but these are very significant to us. One target has a strike length of 1,100 metres, so over a kilometre long. You know, we've got all the ingredients are coming along to bake a very spectacular cake, and then subject to heritage clearance surveys next year, we'll be drilling as soon as the wet season's over.
Luke Harper Chairman Miles Kennedy there. He has a long history of searching for diamonds in the Kimberley, having initially set up the Ellendale mine more than 25 years ago.
At Ellendale, when we started mining there, we started finding a range of diamonds which were yellow through to a vivid, fancy yellow diamond. It's like a canary, you know, it's absolutely jumps out at you. It's so bright and wonderful. And over time, there were two big buyers in the world, a big company out of Hong Kong called Chow Tai Fook, who started buying our yellows and making them prominent. And then Tiffany's out of New York also realized how rare these colored diamonds were. And as time went on, they became more and more valuable. And of course, like the pinks of Argyle, as soon as Ellendale closed, you know, those yellow diamonds went through, the price of them went through the roof.
And there's been that renewed energy around Ellendale. What do you see the potential for the diamond industry growing into with all of this activity and renewed energy around the industry?
Well, you know, I think what we have seen, and possibly the cause for this activity, is that after many years of suppressed diamond prices, the fact of the matter is that the world is running out of natural diamonds. And as a consequence of this, you're seeing the highest prices for gem quality diamonds seen for probably over 10 years. Of course, many of us in Lucapa, including myself, as you know, started the Ellendale mine. So we know this area at Ellendale very well. And whilst, you know, Ellendale has been mined for many years, we've always had the view that there weren't only going to be two diamond mines in Australia. And you know, within a couple of years, we will reopen the Merlin Diamond Mine in the Northern Territory. And hopefully at the same time, we'll have another diamond mine in Western Australia for, of course, what is the rarest stone in the world.
Luke Harper, Diamond Company Chairman. Miles Kennedy ending that report from Courtney Fowler. To actually see this beauty for yourself, just head on over to the ABC Rural website and search ABC Rural Yellow and Diamonds. You can also find that story posted up on the ABC Kimberley Facebook page. You're listening to the WA Country Hour. I'm Jessica Hayes in the chair today for Belinda Varaschetti. And a text has come in from Peter this afternoon responding to that story looking at agriculture, forestry and fishing, once again labelled the most dangerous industries in Australia based on the number of serious injury claims. Peter says, improving safety is a good thing. More regulation, not always. And a Sydney-based academic isn't as much of an agriculture safety expert as, say, a farmer. Thanks for that text in, Peter. If you too would like to join the conversation this afternoon, get in touch. The number is 0448 922 604. It's 20 past 12.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
The Australian government has opened the border for backpackers to return for a working holiday, but it may be some time before many arrive. Western Australia hasn't opened its borders yet, but David Claughton looks at which states will allow that to happen, why some backpackers might end up at the chance, jump at the chance to work in Australia, while others may hesitate.
Backpackers coming to Australia on a 417 working holiday visa can now enter New South Wales, the ACT and Victoria, and they won't have to quarantine. Given COVID is raging again in parts of Europe, some might be keen to come. And recent changes to the tax treatment for travellers and the introduction of a minimum wage for piecework make the idea all the more attractive. Australian farmers are certainly hoping they'll come in droves now the government has opened the borders.
More than welcome the reopening of the borders, because the figures are that we're about 110,000 backpackers down that normally work in service industries. I've got dairy farmers, grain guys, pork industry, chicken industry, they're all screaming out for casual workers.
Chris Diller, chair of the New South Wales Farmers Workplace Relations Committee. Gary Godwill is an orchardist near Shepparton in northeast Victoria. He prefers to employ backpackers for picking because they're smart and motivated.
They come to Australia. A lot of them are university trained. They've organised these trips. They want to improve their English. They also want to see Australia. In order to get around and see these things, they need money.
Gary Godwill says workers can make good money, up to $250 a day if they pick enough apples.
I've had couples bringing in 20 bins a day. At $40 a bin, they're very happy. I'm very happy because I've got a perishable commodity on the tree, and I want it off in time.
For two young German backpackers, Kira and Melina, looking for seasonal work in Australia was a really frustrating experience. They travelled up the east coast to Queensland on the promise of work from a backpacker hostel.
A really hard trip, really a lot of stress and trains and a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we went to the working hostel and they promised us before that we can work there, that we will get money, but still we had to pay for the accommodation.
This is a backpackers hostel that was organising seasonal work on farms for you?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. We had to pay $200 per week. Oh?
For the accommodation?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the accommodation and for the opportunity to work there.
And did you get work?
No.
No,
what
that's
happened?
Right. First they said, like, yeah, we don't have a job at the moment. And then they said, yeah, okay, you have to work at the lemon farms, I think. And then we drove there with a bus, like, for 1 hour, I think. And we worked for, like, 10 minutes and then it started raining. And we couldn't work when it's raining because I think the lemons get broken.
Yeah, they bruise.
Yeah, and then we drove home. And then they also said, like, the next 5 days, I think they had no work for us.
They stayed 2 weeks without work before getting a job offer in regional Victoria.
We met two guys in the working hostel. They were also really desperate already. They were from Italy. And we called every farm on the East Coast, like every farm that we could work in. And we got a job in, near Melbourne, somewhere in the outback, I think.
Yeah.
And we drove there like 24 hours in a car and we arrived and they also promised us, you will be paid per hour. And then we got paid when we picked 400 kilograms of apples. We got
one bin, $50.
And how many bins did you pick that day?
The first day, maybe together two.
And it was really, really hot. Yeah, and we had to start work really early and worked for maybe like 10 hours.
Now, we've spoken to an orchardist only yesterday who says if you're good, you could pick 6 to 10 bins a day.
I don't know, but it didn't seem possible because also the guys who worked there, no one really did more than maybe 4 bins. It took so much time.
How did you feel at the end of a 10-hour day having only been paid 50 bucks?
Horrible.
Super exhausted. Like, I think I never worked that hard.
One day I couldn't work because my arm was like, I couldn't move them.
Kira and Melina didn't find enough work to get their visa extension and went back to Germany via Southeast Asia, where it's cheaper to travel. Later, they tried to get back some of the tax they'd paid while working in Australia, only to discover the employer hadn't delivered it to the government.
We realised it was illegal work because we couldn't get any tax back. We didn't pay tax. They told us we paid the taxes and got it from our income, but they never paid the taxes with that money.
Backpackers were taxed at a higher level than Australians up until recently, when a court case overturned that arrangement. So with the borders open, less tax to pay and a minimum wage for piecework, will backpackers come from places like Germany? Kira and Melina think there are too many obstacles to travel right now.
No, I don't think so.
No. They're closed for a time, yeah, when the country had a lot of corona cases. Then you can't, or it's really difficult to go back to Germany. You have to pay a lot of money for quarantine, and you're not allowed to stay home. You have to pay for a hotel, and it's really expensive then.
If the backpackers don't come, that will disappoint Chris Stillard from the New South Wales Farmers Association, who has a long list of employers needing workers.
There's plenty of work out there, and I've got a list as long as my arm of personal people that I know that would love to employ them to working on their property, and they'll get their fair wage they deserve. So it's an excellent market for a backpacker.
Dave Claughton filed that report with Warwick Long. And I wonder how keen you are to see those backpackers at your place. WA's border yet to reopen some point early next year from the sounds of things. What difference would it make for you right now? Let me know. The number is 0448 922 604. Now, Edith Cowan University will launch Western Australia's first horticulture degree next year. It's being developed by Professor Zora Singh, who hopes it will plug a major research gap.
If you look into the Australian horticulture industry, which is worth of $14.4 billion, with the export of $2.8 billion annually, it's the third largest industry after grains and meat. And then it is expected that horticulture industry will expand up to 33% by 2030. And even in Western Australia, we want to double the production by 2025. And if you look at the whole world, it is expected that 2050, the world population will expand close to 10 billion people on the planet. At the same time, if you look into drivers of production of agriculture, horticulture produce, they're not favoring the production. For example, climate change, soil salinity, shortage of laborers. So all these things are not favoring production, but at the same time, we have to increase production much more to feed those people. So that was a compelling argument to open this program.
So there are other universities in Western Australia have, you know, Murdoch's known for animal science, UWA for plant health. There doesn't seem to really be any emphasis until now on horticulture at any major West Australian university. Does this indicate that you're plugging a bit of a gap in that research field?
If you look historically, first the Bachelor's of Horticulture program was at Murdoch University. Then it was from Murdoch, it was migrated to UW. And that was on production and production horticulture. At the same time, there was a agribusiness horticulture program run by Curtin University. And 2017, they closed down the program. All the programs has been closed down in UWA, Murdoch, and Curtin Uni. There is no university which is catering to the needs of the university and producing graduates or postgraduate in horticulture. So there is a gap. I attended a few weeks ago this Western Australian horticulture update. Industry groups highlighted that we need graduates. We need more people trained in this area.
ECU Professor Zora Singh talking about a new horticulture degree being offered by Edith Cowan University from next year. And to find out more, just head on over to the ECU website. You're listening to the WA Country Hour. I'm Jessica Hayes. It's great to have your company this afternoon. Coming up on the program, Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation has released this report card on the world's fishing industries. Top marks went to countries like Ireland and Norway. They only got a C. Guess what mark Australia's seafood industry was given in this global fishing index? I'll leave that for you to guess. It's not great. More on that shortly, and then you'll be heading off to catch up with Danny Burkett to get a wrap of this week's wool market. But first, it's time to get the news headlines. It is 29 past 12 and Jonathan Hopper's here. Jonathan, what's making news this afternoon?
Good afternoon, Jessica. The company developing WA's first uranium mine in the goldfield says it's beaten a deadline by the state government to begin operations. The former Liberal National government granted environmental approval for the Mulga Rock project, but the approvals only last 5 years, and the current Labor government has since reinstated a ban on uranium mining. Vimy Resources has told the stock market today it submitted documents notifying the Department of Water and Environment Regulation of substantial commencement. An infectious disease researcher says the best way to deal with a new COVID-19 variant discovered in South Africa is to get as many people vaccinated as possible. The UK is suspending flights from 6 African countries on concerns the new variant could impact vaccine efficacy. Health Minister Greg Hunt says there are no changes to Australia's quarantine rules for now. And high rollers will no longer be able to smoke in Crown Casino's VIP room from January 2022. Smoking is banned in enclosed public venues across the state, but until now, Crown had an exemption for its invite-only Pearl Room, which only admits gamblers who turn over $100,000 annually. Thanks, Jess.
Thanks for that update, Jonathan. You have a great weekend. And another text in this afternoon on the text line, this one from Farmer, no name, who is responding to that story about backpackers returning to Australia. He says, my backpackers are great. They earn $400 to $500 a day, and they're happy, and so am I. I just wish Australians would do the work. It would be so good. What do you think? Let me know. The number is 0448 922 604. That number again, 0448 922 604. You're listening to The Country Hour.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
And you're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Jessica Hayes. Fantastic to have you along this afternoon. And heading towards news at 1 o'clock, you'll get a wrap of the wool market with Danny Burkett. And it looks like the market made some small gains this week, so a bit more on that shortly. But now it's time to get an update from the Bureau. Noel Pusey is the duty forecaster. Noel, let's kick things off in the Southwest Land Division. What's happening there? Have we got Noel? Noel? We might.
No.
Oh, we've got Noel now. Noel, sorry about that. Hey, let's kick things off in the Southwest Land Division this afternoon.
Yeah. Okay, well, the whole state's pretty much the same today. It's a very, very lovely day through nearly all of the state. So high pressure ridge south of us, trough developing near the west coast, generally east to southeasterly winds over the southern half, any more east to northeast near the west coast, and it's easterly winds right through northern parts of the state as well. So the only weather today is in the far north Kimberley, where there's a chance of a shower or thunderstorm this afternoon and evening, and through again tomorrow afternoon and evening. But in the south, clear conditions, great harvest sort of weather continues for the next 3 to 4 days. The trough does deepen down the west coast during Saturday, and we get quite warm conditions sort of up to the mid-30s near the west coast, perhaps even a little bit higher than that in certain parts along there in the sort of low west and the central west district. But the trough should move inland late Saturday night into early Sunday morning ahead of a weak cold front to the southwest. Be a little bit of a cooler change in the west coast, down to the low 30s, but maybe one or two showers along the south coast, perhaps stretching up perhaps as far north as Perth, around the corner, and then around the southwest corner, and then along the south coast as well. But only 1 or 2 millimetres out of that, if anything at all. And I think it will remain very hot on and east of the trough as it moves further east through the Esperance area by about Sunday evening into Monday morning. So hot day for much of the west coast and southern parts on Sunday, but the cooler change developing near the west. But it still remained pretty good conditions, I think, for harvesting right through the 4 day period there, and the early part of next week indications show that it's going to continue quite dry in the south and even in the north. Temperatures starting to rise though, some very hot conditions through western parts of the Kimberley over the next few days. Temperatures up to around about the 40 degree mark, and there is a heatwave advice out for western parts of the Kimberley, and it also looks like part of the coastal Gascoyne also becomes near heatwave conditions during next week as well, as the temperatures rise there too.
And any other warnings in place this afternoon, Noel?
fire weather warnings for parts of the Kimberley and the Pilbara, and we might see during tomorrow similar sort of area again, but perhaps also in the coastal Gascoyne too.
No, thank you so much for that, Noel. Noel, we'll catch you again soon. That's Judy forecaster Noel Pusey. And Richard Hudson is here with all the latest rainfall figures for the last 24 hours. Is there much around today, Richard?
No, this won't take long at all. In the northern and eastern forecast districts, that's about the only part. There was a bit of rain, and that was in the Kimberley again. Diggers Rest had 6 and Wyndham had 8. Nothing else in the north or the east, and nothing at all in the Southwest Land Division either. But on yesterday's program, you would have heard Belinda chatting about COVID vaccinations with Pauline Bantock, who's the president of the Shire of Victoria Plains. They were talking about a letter the Shire sent out to all their bushfire volunteers. And that letter says, as of 12:01 a.m. on the 1st of December this year, it will be unlawful for anyone to attend any emergency service building or incident area without at least their first COVID-19 vaccination or a valid exemption. But just to clarify some dates and some details here, the Department of Fire and Emergency Services has been in touch with us. And this is an important clarification. So the DFAS statement says, under the Chief Health Officer's directions, all Department of Fire and Emergency Services staff are required to have received at least one COVID-19 vaccination by the 1st of December and be fully vaccinated by the end of the year, so by the 31st of December, to access a fire and emergency services sites. The directions also require fire and emergency services volunteers to have received at least one vaccination by the end of the year, by the 31st of December, and then be fully vaccinated by the 31st of January next year. That's to access a fire and emergency services site. So that clarification is that there's one extra month for volunteers to get their first vaccination jab.
No worries. Thank you for that update, Richard.
Just before we go, big congratulations to Eric Benning, who we featured on Wednesday's show.
Yes.
He was picked up by the Fremantle Dockers yesterday, so good on you. He's from the Kimberley. He's on his way.
Richard walking into the office was like a kid in a candy store. Very, very happy indeed. You're listening to The Country Hour this afternoon. It's 23 minutes to one. Now, a damning fish stocks report released by Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation has been slammed by the seafood industry. The Mindaroo Foundation is a philanthropic organisation and this week released this Global Fishing Index, which it calls the largest independent assessment of global fish stocks to date. Australia is given a D on the report card after concluding that half of the assessed fish stocks are overfished. Lucinda Jose tried to find out why the mark was so low, and she's with Dr. Tony Warby from the Mindaroo Flourishing Oceans Initiative.
Dr. Warby, this index paints a pretty bleak picture. You give Australia a D. Why is that?
So the index pulls together the status of fish stocks as well as the status of fisheries governance in 142 different countries, including Australia, and all of those countries have an exclusive economic zone in which they engage in fishing activities. And what we've done is to really consult as widely as we possibly can right across the world. We've engaged with experts on the ground in each of those countries to get the best data that we can to make an assessment at an individual species level of the status of fish stocks, and then pull those two components together into an overall score, and they're the scores that are reported in the index.
Yeah, so you look at stocks for more than 1,500 stocks in 142 coastal countries. The report notes that in many fisheries, there's not sufficient data to determine the status. How do you fit all the data and the lack of data into a country-level grade from sort of A to F?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I guess the first thing I would say, there's nothing simple about fisheries or fisheries management or the collection of fisheries data. I'm sure your listeners would appreciate that, you know, it's not like counting something on land where you can see it or you can go and visit it. It is incredibly difficult, and we're the first people to recognise that. The challenge, I think, is that You know, we have a saying that there's always plenty more fish in the sea. And so there is an expectation, I think, that the ocean does deliver an endless resource to us, that we can pretty much go and take what we want. Obviously, fisheries managers take a different approach. They really do try and manage a fishery. And obviously, the best of the industry players are also doing that. But really, what we've tried to do through this report is to highlight the fact that in so many places around the world, and in fact in every country, including Australia, there are overfished stocks. And some of them have rebuilding plans in place, some of them have fisheries closures, but not all of them do. And depending which country you look at all around the world, mechanisms may or may not be in place, either to recognise the extent of the problem or to have any capacity or willingness to do anything about it. And so when you do a global assessment, you have to kind of treat every country consistently. You have to look at the data that you can get for every country to inform your report. And that's the approach that we've taken here.
Seafood producers in Australia have labelled this report poorly researched and a biased attack to generate publicity for Mindaroo. Is it?
No, I'm kind of disappointed to hear them say that, because we've tried to be really consultative throughout this process. You know, it's definitely not about generating publicity for Mindaroo. That's not our business model. That's not what we're about. We're about identifying where there's issues in the world that need to be grappled with. And in this case, it's really about the health of the ocean. You know, as far as the research goes, we've engaged with a lot of different countries all around the world. We've got four times more data in this report than some of the UN reports that focus on self-reported data. But is it perfect? No. We're the first to acknowledge that. There's always a tendency, I think, for getting into an argument about numbers and whose numbers are right, rather than focusing on the fact that there are some real issues in every country in the world when it comes to overfishing. And that's really what we're trying to bring our attention to.
Mindaroo, you are, as you mentioned, you're a philanthropic organisation that takes on sort of persistent issues, in this case, the health of the world's fish stocks. Your partner organisation, Tattering, is a private investment group pursuing aquaculture projects, and you've said you want to be part of the solution. Are you highlighting the problem in order to build a business on it?
No, that's not the case. And so the philanthropic arm, Mindaroo, and the commercial arm are very separate. So I can't speak on behalf of Tattering. What I would say, though, is that, you know, it's very public that Andrew Forrest has invested into Huon. Obviously, there's lots of complexity in the way that story has played out. But I think in all of those businesses, there has been a commitment to driving a sustainability agenda. And I'm sure if Andrew was being interviewed right now, he would say that his goal there was to change the industry from the inside out, that there are issues around sustainability with aquaculture that need to be addressed. But it's really a very different rationale, I guess, than the philanthropic arm that I work for.
The report has been compiled and released. What happens now? Do you repeat it again?
Yes. So we're planning to republish this report every 3 years. So 2024, 27 and 2030, out to the end of the decade. And really to measure progress towards our goal of ending overfishing by the end of the decade. That's a hugely ambitious goal. We're not naive about the challenge. It's going to take a really concerted effort by organisations like our own, working with governments, working with industry, working with the general public and wreck fishers to really encourage everybody to look themselves in the mirror and ask, are we doing enough to solve this problem? And the first step in solving a problem is recognizing there is a problem. And so, you know, we'll just continue to advocate for better management, to raise awareness of the problems, and to really, hopefully, measure really strong progress every 3 years through to the end of the decade as we release this report. And I would just add to that, we'll be looking to improve the way that we generate the report as well as we go.
Dr. Tony Warby, who is the CEO of the Flourishing Oceans Initiative with the Mindaroo Foundation. Now, Veronica Papacosta is the CEO of Seafood Industry Australia, which is the peak body representing Australia's seafood industry. And she's labelled the report simplistic and inaccurate.
So we didn't have any consultation. We weren't involved in the process. We know that they had perhaps reached out to some other organisations like the FRDC for some high-level consultation. But for something that cuts to the heart of the industry as directly as this attempts to, we would have expected a much higher level of consultation and working in collaboration, working together.
What about your industry members, those people who are actually out on the water? Do you know if any of those people were visited or spoken to?
No, not at all. I mean, to put it in context, as far as we understand now, as we've sort of been able to pull some details out around the process that they conducted, only 19% of available fisheries data in Australia was used, that was funneled into the report and relied on. So 19% we don't think is a strong enough level of assessment.
What's your response to the findings of this report? Australia received a D grade for its fisheries management. How do you respond to that?
Look, for us, it just, like it's happened to us before, it feels like a biased attack. It feels like that the purpose was to generate publicity, perhaps try to, take some wins that can be recorded against next year, but it definitely doesn't feel like a reflection of what's happening on the ground in Australian fisheries management. The report itself gave us a rating of 10 out of 12, which was for governance, which was the highest rating they awarded any country in the world. But what we're to infer immediately following that in the report is that the 10 out of 12 governance model resulted in a very below par performance. And we just can't reconcile that.
You're saying you don't feel the Mindaroo assessment was thorough enough, but is there a need for some form of global assessment?
It's an interesting question because I think that we are always open to the questions around sustainability, around fisheries management. It's a good conversation to be having within Australia and globally. One of the concerns is lumping Australia in with all other international fisheries as one global entity undermines countries like Australia. It also undermines countries like the US and New Zealand and the UK. We're always open to the conversation, but to have reports and potentially reports in inverted commas created that go to the heart of Australian fisheries management, don't make clear recommendations around the difference, it can be very dangerous. It can be very misleading. I mean, consumers are as interested in the conversation around sustainability as the seafood industry. And so we want to have those conversations, but we feel that increasingly we're being assessed and judged by rules and guidelines that we have no control, that we can't acknowledge as fair and reasonable. The lack of transparency around things like this and around reports like the Mindaroo report is really concerning for us.
Veronica Papacosta is the CEO of Seafood Industry Australia, and she was speaking to Joe Prendergast. And a few texts coming in on the text line this afternoon, like this one from Andrew, who says, Andrew Forrest Mindaroo Foundation brings out a report giving the world a very poor mark on world fish stocks. He says it obviously has nothing to do with his foray into fish farming, similar to him wanting the diesel fuel rebate scrapped and the money diverted into green hydrogen, which has nothing to do with his foray into that. That text in from Andrew. And this one in from Mike, who says this is all about Twiggy promoting his own farmed seafood business. His ego gets bigger each day. And Peter, who says a business selling shares in firms investing into fisheries runs a philanthropic arm that goes woke-splaining on fisheries worldwide, and people wonder why I have trust issues. That text in from Peter. Share your thoughts on the text line this afternoon. The number is 0448 922 604. It's 12 to 1. Now, foreign ownership and corporatisation of agriculture has made the dream of farm ownership challenging for many across rural Australia. But in a region with one of the highest levels of foreign ownership in the country, locals are fighting back by buying back the family farm. Lachlan Bennett filed this report for Landline.
The fertile farmlands of Circular Head in Tasmania's northwest have attracted investors from across the world. It's some of the best dairy country in Australia, and young farmers Ryan and Bridget Langley dream of one day having a place to call their own.
So we've got a 18-month-old and one on the way due in February. Yeah, hopefully they enjoy the passion as much as we do and that we can pass it down to them.
But in Circular Head, that dream can sometimes feel more of a fantasy.
Someone told me that only in the Circle Head there's only 9 family farms as such.
Left.
That's not corporate ownership, which takes away the opportunity of the dream of owning your farm, because they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, you know, you're talking 1,800 cows, 1,000 cow farms. They come with a big price tag.
The rise of corporate and foreign-owned farmland has made the dream of farm ownership challenging for many young families. According to a submission to the Foreign Investment Review Board, foreign entities, from North American pension funds to Chinese businessmen, control more than 60% of Circular Head's milk production. That's a figure that raised alarm bells for agribusiness entrepreneur Stephen Fisher.
We need to keep giving people the opportunity to come into the industry and have some ownership in it. And I could see that the corporate models that were out there were limiting that opportunity.
Stephen's solution was to create a new type of corporate called Circular Head Farms to try and bolster local ownership. It works like this. They raise funds from local investors to buy farms and find sham farmers like the Langleys to run them. Farmers build up the business with the goal of eventually buying the herd and a stake in the farm.
So generally, share farmers, it's probably fair to say, want to come in and they want to initially build a herd. So we allow our share farmers to rear surplus calves. Ultimately, they can start with very little and over time build up into cow ownership. And even ultimately, our goal is to see them start to come into ownership of the farm. We're not here to hand out free passes to our share farmers. We offer an opportunity, but they've got to work for it and they've got to make it happen. So it's about understanding what are their goals and how can we be part of the solution. Because I simply believe that if we've got highly motivated people running these farms, then we're all going to do really well out of that.
Since acquiring their first farm in 2014, Circular Head Farms has grown into a network of 11 dairies, more than 4,000 hectares of farmland, and 8,500 milking cows. Meanwhile, their first share farmer, Cody Korpishok, now owns his own herd and a 40% stake in another property. And for Mr. Fisher, that's really what it's all about. Providing opportunities for locals, not opposing foreign ownership.
I just want to see us as a community reap the rewards. You know, wealth's created owning the farm. Wealth's not created working on the farm. If you want to create wealth for your community, then you own it.
Dairy farmer Paul Lambert has been with Circular Head Farms since its inception, and he currently oversees the operation as chair. He says there's no point getting upset about what might have happened in the past.
And in the last couple of years, the foreign ownership in dairy farms in Tasmania has actually dropped back a little bit. Some of these farms, if you go back not so many years, they were hard to sell. And we had real estate agents trying to sell them, you know, pitch them all over the world. So we can't really, I don't think we can get angry or upset about it. It's just how it's gone. But certainly being a part of the solution and keeping it in local hands, I think, is a much better way to go.
Lambert says Circular Head Farms has managed to recruit more than 70 investors. And while profit is important, that's not the main pitch.
The pitch is really around the community and what we are trying to achieve in terms of local ownership and giving these young people a good pathway to eventually farm ownership.
Circular Head Farms Chair Paul Lambert ending that report from Lachlan Bennett. And if you want to hear more about Circular Head Farms or see some of that spectacular dairy country in Tasmania's northwest, you can catch that story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30 or later on iView. It's absolutely magnificent, and keep an eye out for the online story as well. I'm sure it'll be beautiful.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. Join me for The World Today. Australian boots on the ground as foreign powers blamed for riots causing chaos and destruction in the Solomon Islands, and why Honiara's relationship with China might be a central part of the problem. And just as Australia winds back restrictions, a new COVID variant emerges in Africa, which has the potential to be extremely infectious and bypass vaccines. You'll hear these stories coming up on The World Today.
And it's 6 minutes to 1 o'clock to the wool market now, where there were some small gains made this week, I believe. The Eastern market indicator was up 17 to close at 13.41. Here in the West, the market was up 8 to close at 14.01. Danny Burkett is here to walk you through this week's market. Hey, Danny, can you walk us through the details this afternoon?
Yeah, we had 6,829 bales offered in Fremantle. We cleared 6,401. So across the board, we had 18 microns, 15 cheaper on the first day, 15 dearer on the second, to remain par for the week on 1970. 19 micron closed at 1630. That was up 5 for the week. 20 microns, again, off 15 on the first day, up 15 on the second. So that remains par for the week on 1340 clean. 21 closed at 1285. That was up 5. 22's up 10, closing at 1265. Pieces and bellies across the board, regardless of micron or VM, were all 20 cents dearer. And if we look at a 20 micron, interestingly at the moment, there is only 40 cents spread between pieces and fleece. That usually suggests that that micron is under some sort of pressure. We had lambs remain firm. We had locks, stains and crutchings all 20 to 30 dearer. Across the three centres in Australia, we cleared $56 million worth of wool, and year to date, that equates to 963. So a reasonable market given what the backdrop is at the moment, with restricted finance, with logistics and shipping slowing. So I think a very good result for what we have in the background.
I mean, how are some of those shipping issues going at the moment? I know we've spoken to you about that before. Are we seeing any reprieve on the horizon, Danny?
I can't suggest on the horizon, but at the moment, only speaking the fact of where we are, no, they're still the same. So we're still struggling to move containers out of Fremantle for wool, and that further help doesn't help the problem, because if you can't ship the wool, you can't get your line of credit open, you can't get your money, so that stops you from entering the market because you don't have the finances. So well, hopefully in the coming months, that does start to alleviate.
And who was buying this week, Danny?
TNU, 17.4% of the merino fleece wool across the country. Teckwell Trading, 15.8%. PJ Morris, the West Australian-based business, 13.3%. And Mellawa, a Chinese-based business, at 9.6%. They're not usually in the top four or three, so it's good to see another company coming in. Again, just to mention, crossbred pieces and bellies across the country, Teckwell Trading, 15.5%. If we look at the skirtings also, 22.8%. Teckwell Trading. So again, Teckwell very strong, but good to see TNU take that top spot. Again, we've had Teckwell just driving this market for 6 months, so it's great to see when they pulled the reins back that someone's there ready to take the spot.
And Danny, what are we looking at next week? Because there's not that many weeks left of this calendar year, is there?
I think we have three more sales left. Next week we have Sydney, Melbourne, Fremantle. Sydney is a designated superfine sale. As I've said before, that restricts the amount of top-making wools, which are the bread and butter West Australian types, onto the market. Last time was sale 16. We had a super fine sale in Sydney. Overall, the top makers ended up about 80 deer up in that week. On sale 19, we had a designated super fine sale in Sydney, but we ended up 40 cents cheaper across all top-making wools. So hopefully we can revert back to sale 16 and have a good result next week.
Absolutely. Now, Danny, before I let you go, I've got Richard Hudson. Oh, whispering in my ear, did you catch the draft on the weekend?
No, I did not, Richard.
No, he says he hasn't. Well, Richard looks disappointed. Thank you so much for that, Danny. You have a fantastic weekend and we'll catch up with you next week.
Very good. Thank you.
That's Danny Burkett from West Coast Wools. That's almost it for the Country Hour for another week. But there are a few more texts coming in on the text line, running hot this afternoon about that report from Mindaroo into global fish stocks. This one's come in from Glenn. He says, if we have about 6 to 7% of the fish in the ocean there were 100 years ago, we are ignoring a serious problem. That one from Glenn. This one's come in from Murray at South Yalbini. He says, I once thought Twiggy was an idealist, and now I'm waiting for his next headline to be about him starting a unicorn stud, mining for fairy dust, or getting the Beatles back for one last world tour. That text in from Murray at South Yalbini. And a very important text here from Tim and Cooper, who were harvesting at West Karoo today. Tim says, I attended a fire yesterday. Turns out they weren't asking for a vaccine certificate. I think they thought getting the fire out was more important. Thank you for that text in, Tim, just talking about vaccine mandates and, I guess, the impact on volunteer activity this summer. And just on the story relating to backpackers starting to flow back into Australia in the other states, remains to be seen when we'll see that happen here in WA. But this text has come in from Patrick at Manjimup, who says, backpackers at the last vineyard I worked at didn't have $30,000 in superannuation paid in either. The permanent and two permanent casuals, $20,000 in superannuation as well before the place went into insolvency again. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's been really fun. I'll catch you next time. You're off to the news now. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.